And I realized earlier today that I think I gave my first ever scientific talk or something in this room, something like a decade ago. So I can't guarantee that my presentation will be any better than the one 10 years ago as an undergrad, a third year undergrad, but I hope it is. And so yeah, so today it'll be about this thing we call covariant quantum error correction and some applications. What we're doing is we're gonna be sort of going through these two papers. And I really wanna, so let me say this right off the bat. There's a lot of heavy duty math in both of these in different parts of the paper, and lots of applications, lots of examples and things like that. So there's a lot going on, but I don't think it's, I don't want to cloud the talk in any way by going through these. I just wanna have a very pedestrian sort of talk through what we're doing, and leave most of the examples, the hard math, this kind of stuff to the interested reader. And so we'll start with these two topics, how you error correct quantum reference frame information, if this is possible and how that would work, and this thing we call covariant quantum error correction. And these are really sort of two sides of the same coin, two different ways of looking at the same problem. So we'll define what these are. We'll have an operational and sort of a mathematical interpretation and go from there. And we end up with sort of a theorem, tell you when these things, when you can and cannot do these things. And then we'll try to relax this to make everything approximate. And naturally, it may not be, it's probably not yet apparent, but this naturally says something about the Easton-Knill theorem. So we'll try to figure out what we can say about quantum computation, and then time permitting, I think we should have time, but also, yeah, so we'll talk about symmetries and ADS-CFT and stuff like that. So the first paper was with, so I can't forget these great people. So the first paper was with Sepper Nizami, Patrick Hayden, Sandu Popescu a couple years ago. And then the follow-up that was more recent was with the rest of them, Philippe Feist, Sepper Nizami, Victor Albert, Fernando Pustowski, Patrick Hayden, and John Preskill. So good. So let's start on this first one, reference frame information. So normally in both classical and quantum information theory, what we're talking about is transmission or encoding or something of these abstract bits. Like classically, you send a message, you send a text. There's some bits that are sent, or communicating with words, things like that. So these are, I'm sending messages using these abstract symbols. And in the quantum setting, the analog of that is just storing information in qubits or qubits or something like that. Okay, so that's usually what we talk about. But there's a whole other kind of information that's more physical, that it's anything, it's sort of defined this way, it's anything that can't be described using abstract symbols like this. It has different names in the literature. Sometimes I think it's also called unspeakable, but anyway, we'll call it physical information. Okay, so let's do an example of this and see what I'm talking about. So here I have a problem. I have Alice and Bob, and the task is that Alice wants to send some information to Bob, and the information she wants to send is the direction, some direction in space, some vector. And let's make it concrete and say that she wants to specify the axis of rotation of some gyroscope. Okay. Crucially here, Alice and Bob share a common reference frame, so they know their relative alignment. So what Alice can do is she can just measure the components, the three components of this gyroscope, and then send Bob an email with those components, and he'll just build a gyroscope in his lab, and success, we win. Okay, so now Bob has the same gyroscope, or the same, he has the information about this direction. But it was crucial here that they had the same reference frame. Yeah?
Does this apply to any speed?
So far, this is classical, fully classical. Okay, only classical so far. But hold that thought. So now what happens if Alice and Bob don't share a reference frame? Bob is, let's even say, so Alice and Bob, they are in distant galaxies. They don't know their orientation, but they can communicate. And they're in distant galaxies, so they can't, you know, use the stars to try to align or something. There's no way for them to find a common reference frame a priori. So Alice can do the same thing. She can measure the components of this vector, send it to Bob through this channel, and then Bob will build it, but he'll get it wrong. You know, it's that he has a different reference frame.
Sorry.
Up is whatever. And so he builds it wrong, and they fail. And naturally, we under, like, okay, can you do this? Is it possible? How? Well, they had a, classically, it's not so bad. They had a communication channel. So Alice can just build another gyroscope in her lab and send the full physical system over to Bob. So then they win. Bob has a copy of the direction that Alice wanted to send. But what if this channel between them was noisy? What if there's an erasure? On the way, you can lose the gyroscope and then they would fail. Can you use some kind of error correcting code? And yeah, sure, you can just use redundancy like you normally do. Alice will build several copies of the gyroscope, send them all, maybe one of them gets erased. But with high probability, they won't all be erased. And then Bob gets a copy of the gyroscope. Okay, cool. And now, because it's all glowing and wavy, this is a quantum reference frame. So an example of that, we'll replace the gyroscope with, say, a spin or something like that. But more generally, it's any sort of quantum system that is a physical system that will transform between the two reference frames. If you change from one to the other, then the state itself would transform. Can you apply the same techniques here? Can you find an error correcting code to send this through a noisy channel and still be able to do achieve this protocol? Now, in this reference frame picture, Alice and Bob had reference frames that were misaligned. Okay, so what that means is that Alice and Bob are related by an unknown rotation. So there's some element of the rotation group SO3 that takes Alice's frame to Bob's frame. You could have done this instead of saying, you know, relative alignment. They could have been off by a time standard. They didn't have synchronized clocks. And then instead of being an SO3 group, there's some other group, and it's going to be U1 in that case. More generally, there's some symmetry group, and Alice and Bob are related by an unknown element of that group. So we want to know, can you do quantum error correction of this kind of information? So here's the picture. So we'll stick with this example of you know, physical reference frame, but reference frame in the literature tends to just mean some sort of something for an arbitrary symmetry group. And Alice and Bob are not, they're related by an unknown element of that group. Alice has some physical information. She wants to encode it and send it through this noisy channel. Okay? Bob will receive a state in his frame. It'll be working in Bob's frame now, it'll be a transformed state, but he'll still receive some you know, noisy state. And he wants to apply a decoder that can't depend on the relative group element. It has to be G independent. Once he does this, he decodes and he gets some state in his reference frame, which, if they were able to send it through a hypothetical channel, they could verify, they could confirm that they were, in fact, the same state. That's the success condition. Okay, so let's, before I do, let me emphasize. So in the picture, we show it for a 1 into 3, like a Qtrick code type of secret sharing scheme. This is without loss of generality. You can do this arbitrarily. You can have n, 1 into n. You can use different codes and things like that. This is just for illustration. So let's make this more precise. Alice has the state in her frame. She wants to encode using some encoding map where the subscript represents that it's in her frame. Okay, so she gets some encoded state. She sends it to Bob through this noisy channel. We modeled the noise as erasure, and Bob will get some noisy state in his frame. So that the noise model being erasure means that I've lost one of the spins we're saying here. We're using these physical systems. We lost a spin. But nevertheless, in Bob's state, because there was this unknown rotation or group element between the two, there's some unitaries applied to each physical system that correspond to some representation of the group between the two.
Why are they different unitaries?
They could be different representations. They could be the same unitary. But it's important that I'm right. So the subscripts here are just labeling the physical systems. It's important here that it's the same, in this case, R rotation. But they can be different reps. Okay. Yeah. So Bob will get some state in his frame. And his task is to apply a decoder or a recovery channel that does not depend on the relative rotation to get some state in his frame. The tilde here is sort of signifying that this is in Bob's frame. And now they could confirm through some hypothetical perfect channel or whatever that the state that Bob got was the same as what Alice had, just in a different reference frame. That's the success condition. Is this clear? Other questions? Okay, so this is what we want to do. This is called reference frame quantum error correction. We don't know yet if you can do this. And I mentioned there was a separate way of looking at the problem that we called covariant quantum error correction. So here it is. In the last couple of slides, the task was to error correct some information that would transform. Here, what we're doing is we're trying to find We're trying to offload that transformation property into the encoding map being covariant with respect to the group. So I'll say this in more detail in the next slide, but roughly the intuition is that it shouldn't matter if you first encode, sorry, if you first transform your input state and then encode, or just encode and then transform on the other side. This is what it would mean for it to be covariant. And so that's the definition. If you're given some map, any map, but in this case, the map will be a quantum error correct encode from the logical space to n physical qubits, it's called covariant if it has this property. Okay. And so in a sense, it's like saying that the map commutes with the action of the group. That's really all it is. And because each physical system itself will transform under the group, you see that each physical system will get its own unitary applied sort of in big tensor product. Okay. Well, we said it was an encoding map, and so we want to be able to decode, so there should be some recovery channel that'll get you back to the input state perfectly. And what we're doing is we're saying, okay, of all the possible encodings, find those that satisfy this property. And this is a pretty strong constraint. In general, there need not exist such encoders. So we're looking for that. Is this picture clear? So we had two pictures. One was reference frame error correction, the other was covariant error correction. These were the defining equations. This was saying that the state that Bob decoded in his reference frame should be equal to Alice's up to this change of basis. And on the covariant side, it was saying that you could first transform then encode or vice versa. So by looking at these equations, you can kind of see that suppose there exists a covariant encoder. There exists an E that is covariant. You could use that map to do reference frame quantum error correction, and you can see that, you know, if this EA here was actually a covariant code, you could pull these unitaries out, you'd get your daggers, everything would cancel, and what you would end up is this equation. So if there exists a covariant encoder, then you can do reference frame encoding. The reverse is also true, that if you could do reference frame encoding, then you would take that map that you used to encode, and it turns out that by averaging over the group, you can build a map that is covariant. And we'll see an example of that in a second.
Sorry, can you say again something about the UNs? You're just allowing them, they could be trivial, right? It's just it could be a totally different representation of this group.
That's right.
I mean, because decoherence free subspaces give reference frame, well, not the error correction part, but they, you know, reference frame independent encoding.
Uh-huh.
That's been known for a long time, right?
So each U can be a different representation. They can be, each physical system can be different dimension, different systems, and so clearly the group will act in different ways in different representations, as long as the group element is the same.
I'm talking specifically about the U in.
Oh, U in, sorry.
So that, you're adding that to let it be the most general.
We want this to be some representation of big group. I mean, we wouldn't really want to look at the trivial case where.
Well, for covariant error correction, you're not too interested in the trivial case, but for reference frame QEC, it seems like that's the thing you're most interested in, right?
The trivial case?
Isn't it?
No, because if in this on this side, what you want is that the information you're encoding actually does transform under the group. If it didn't, then it wouldn't be so interesting. Sort of the opposite way. Here we allow it, but yeah. But because they are
On the left hand side, you want UN to be a faithful representation.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say that's
on the right hand side, you don't insist.
In general, it doesn't need to be. But actually, because these are the equivalent, they should, morally you would like for it to be. The definition was just that the encoder has this property for any sort of group and representation.
They're equivalent for the same representation you in, right?
Like, exactly.
You get it.
You could have a different one on the right.
That, you know, the application kind of being the implied application on the left-hand side, you want something faithful, and the implied application on the right-hand side.
Exactly.
Certainly.
Yeah. Okay, so for our purposes, these are equivalent, but we still don't yet know when they're possible, when either of them is possible, and if so, or how. And if there aren't more questions, I'll just tell you the answer. This is the answer. We break it down as follows. You say, okay, the symmetry group that we cared about can be either finite or sort of continuous. And the systems that we use to encode can be finite or infinite dimensional, continuous. And it turns out that if the group is finite, you can always there always exist covariant codes. We have explicit constructions. I won't really say anything about them in this talk, but they exist. In the infinite dimensional case, there always exist covariant codes. I'll touch on this one. And then there's this no-go theorem here saying that if you have a finite dimensional code, it can't be covariant with respect to any continuous symmetry.
Yeah, so again, this is partly where I was going. I mean, if the UN representation is a trivial representation or just a finite dimensional representation, then you can achieve that, right? I mean, for instance, you can concatenate.
I see what you're saying.
It's free subspace.
I see. You're saying if the logical space doesn't transform, say, then on the physical space, you can apply gates.
Or if the continuous group is broken down to some finite symmetry group, that there is a finite representation.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I see. Okay, so yeah, I guess implicitly I'm saying that the logical space also transforms. Yeah, no, good point. Thank you. Okay, so these are the results. And this we'll start with this one, this no-go theorem here. Hopefully, it's a pedestrian talk, so I'm not going to prove much, but I'll sort of sketch how you might think about this. So you had a continuous symmetry, which means there's at least one infinitesimal generator. On the physical side, you know, the input side, we call that generator TL. And on the output side, on the logical side, the input, there's this TL. And on the physical side, we call it TA. A is sort of representative of the physical space. And yeah, so we're assuming that they're non-trivial. Because each physical system is supposed to transform under the group, we can see that the generator on the physical side is really just a sum of local terms. Each spin or each thing will transform itself as a tensor product, and so the generators are just going to be in this sum. Okay. And now we want to mix this with error correction. So we have a state psi at the bottom. We encode it, and it gets sent through some channel. Again, the noise is erasure, so somewhere along the way, we lose one. Bob collects these and wants to decode using the recovery channel and get back the input. But let's see what actually happened to this one that was erased. It went to an environment. Okay, so if we had these generators, logical and physical, on each side, then the reduced density matrix here could be collected by an adversarial environment. And somebody could measure this, you know, the corresponding local charge operator. So if the code is covariant, it means it conserves charge. So the input logical charge is sort of mapped to the output. And an adversary could measure locally and get some information about that charge. But if it's a good quantum code, it's supposed to map any reduced density matrix that's, you know, it's not correctable, should not have any information about the input. And so since it's supposed to be independent of the input, that answer for, you can just follow through here, you see that the only way out is if the generators themselves are trivial. Is that clear? Is that not clear? This is kind of intuition for the thing. So there are questions? Yeah.
So this assumes that you have that the type of error that you're correcting for is erasure of one subsystem, and that the way that the symmetry acts on those subsystems is independently on each one.
Yeah. So the symmetry acting sort of independently on each one is important. The erasure of one is not so crucial. It could actually just be some subset of the physical systems can be erased as long as that's itself a correctable error. You could still measure the local charge on that subset. Yeah.
See the channel.
Sorry, I didn't quite. Yeah.
Usually, people can see the poly channel.
Uh-huh.
Why are you here?
Why erasure? Well, so erasure is kind of broad. I mean, if you can correct for an erasure on one system, it's like saying you could apply an arbitrary unitary to that one system and still correct, right? Because if you throw it away, you can still apply anything to it and still.
Is it just a partial trace?
Yeah. So
partial trace can be considered like kind of a quantum channel know, map from any dimension to a dimension one case. It's like a D to one quantum map. A more general case is, you know, like from D in to D out.
Okay.
The output can have other dimension.
Right.
That's more general than invaders.
Okay.
Yeah. So what I say, invaders channel is not the most general case channels.
But I think what you said would also work.
Yeah.
I think it would still hold.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I don't know how much of what we did is actually crucially erasure. I think it's just as long as it's. I think it's really just sort of like you need the decoupling theorem, and that will hold it regardless. So, yeah.
I mean, for exact codes, kind of correcting arbitrary errors on an unknown qubit is equivalent to erasing.
Exactly.
Being able to correct for erasure of two qubits.
Right. Here, these were located erasures.
Yeah. So.
But
right.
But still.
So the previous slide. So in this charge argument, so.
Sorry, this slide, yeah.
Yeah, charge
yeah.
Argument.
Yeah.
So I need to think about the input state, which could be a mixture of different charges.
Uh huh.
Charge neutral, nothing. So right.
Mm-hmm.
So then, I just want to make sure if I understand. So if I know that. Charge difference, like if total, if I consider superposition of two states with different charges, then by local measurement, I learn something about the input.
Mm-hmm.
So the input shouldn't have a fixed charge, right?
It can have fixed charge. Could have fixed charge.
I think have fixed charge then. The local charge measurement can tell me anything.
Why?
I mean, the question of whether the global charge is fixed or the local charge is right.
I can think about some subspace of like U1 system and then subspace like two dimensional Hilbert space with fixed total charge. And meanwhile, you erase the output. Like, I think it's still a code. So.
Well, actually, I will do an example with U1. If you want to see this, okay. good. Not to cut you off, but I'll yeah. All right. So this was right. So this was for finite systems. There are no covariant codes. But in that chart, I had that for infinite dimensional systems, there are covariant codes with respect to a continuous picture. And so the easiest way to see that these exist, and I will get to your example in a second, but the easiest way to see that these exist is by going back to this reference frame encoding picture. So there, Alice wants to encode some physical information that will transform, but she's going to use infinite dimensional or continuous variable systems. So the way she does this is as follows. She has her information, and she just picks her favorite error correcting code, non-covariant, just whatever it happens to be. Just use her good old favorite one. So in this case, let's say it's the 3 Qutrit code or something. Qutrit, however, here each of these are infinite dimensional systems. They're continuous variable. Okay. The thing that she wants to do is to be able to send this to Bob in such a way that he can recover without having a shared reference frame. So what she does is she encodes her reference frame into this continuous variable system. So she makes sort of the analog of a classical gyroscope by just using the infinite dimensionality of her system to perfectly specify her reference frame. Okay, now she may actually need a few of these to get, you know, like each direction or something, but just let this suffice to say that she's encoding her entire reference frame in this one gyroscope, say. Now, since the whole thing is sent through an erasure channel, they could all be, any one of them could be erased. So, okay, we use the same trick and build in redundancy on this one as well. She sends that whole system to Bob. Some erasure happens. And what Bob does is he collects this, and he measures any one of the surviving things and fixes his reference frame to match Alice. And now he just uses the decoder for this non-covariant code, and they succeed. So somehow, by using these infinite dimensional systems, Alice was able to encode her reference frame perfectly. Bob was able to make sort of a perfect precision measurement, and then they could succeed. If any of these were finite, then now she won't. There'll be some sort of like fluctuation in the relative alignment, and they won't succeed with perfect fidelity. So this is how you can see that in an infinite dimensional setting, you can do reference frame error correction to see that this corresponds to a covariant code. This is what you do in that language. They use the non-covariant favorite encoding. They append some reference frame gyroscope. And the way you do this is by saying the Hilbert space you're going to use, you're just going to associate that to the group. So one basis vector for the Hilbert space for each element of the group. Since this was continuous, this is continuous. Alice's reference frame is then just the identity element in her basis. The identity element. So what she'll send him is this. In Bob's frame, he'll get something where you've transformed each of these using the group, because they're in some different basis. And you can make a covariant code by averaging over the group. So you can check for yourself that if you transform the inside here, change basis, sorry, just do a change of variable, that gives you something on the outside, and this is in fact a covariant code.
Sorry, are we still in the finite group setting,
or is this just... No, we are in the continuous group setting. So G is continuous, and so the Hilbert space you're using is continuous. You can use a similar trick in the finite setting, actually. But
what's the point of the two ancillas?
In this picture, it was so that Bob could measure one of them, and learn the reference frame. The reason number two is because each of them could be subjected to noise. So when you send all five of these things, any one of them could be lost. So you need at least one more. You need at least two gyroscopes. And the ancilla are playing the role of that gyroscope. It's encoding Alice's reference frame. It tells Bob in Alice's frame. So what in this picture, what Bob does is he gets these. He measures sort of this projective measurement like onto GG. And he'll figure out what G is. So he'll collapse this to some G. And then he can decode, because he now knows G. Cool? OK, so an example. This is for a rotor system. So a rigid rotor, it's some system. It has an angular variable phi, which is the analog of position. And the conjugate variable is the momentum k. Since this is compact and periodic, momentum is discrete. And it's doubly infinite. So k takes integer values from minus infinity to infinity. The task now is to find a covariant code where we use rotors as the physical systems, the infinite dimensional systems. So I claim that this encoder given by this isometry is a covariant code. So here's an explicit code. This is the isometry. So it takes an input value x and spits out this. This is the encoded version.
If you go back a slide, yeah. You said you were in the infinite case, but is that how you prove existence in the finite case, is just doing some randomized construction?
That will work. There are other techniques. I can show you later. I have nothing in here for finite. OK, so you can look at this and convince yourself it's a code. Suppose you apply this to one code word x. You'll get this thing here. You can just look at a reduced density matrix of 1. It'll be a sum over y, so it'll be independent of x once you change variables. So it will be a good code. I claim it's covariant with respect to u1, which acts on this as edi theta k. Although they're called x and y, these are actually momentum variables. That's why they're integer valued. And so we can check that this is covariant. Transform the input with this group element. It's diagonal in this basis, so you pick up an x. This is now a scalar, so it comes through. And then we just rewrite x as this thing. You can check minus 3y plus y plus 2y is 0. Minus x plus 2x is x. The reason it was this is because, well, I can get this by applying the group on each one of these separately. And so sure enough, this is a covariant encoding. And it's also a perfect error correcting code.
Okay.
So Benny, I guess I could have here applied this to a particular input state x prime, which is just one value of the charge k. And it works. Okay. So this is very much the same as sort of the Easton-Knill theorem. But in case some of you don't know this, so the question is it possible to apply a universal set of gates, any logical unitary, by only acting with transversal gates on the physical systems? And transversal really just means tensor product on each of the systems. Okay. And what Easton-Knill showed is that no, there's a tension between your ability to correct and your ability to do transversal gates. Essentially, they showed that any logical group that you generate with transversal gates will always be a finite group. So you can't get something dense in the unitaries. Okay. Well, in our language, we just set the group that we care about to be the logical unitary group. And we're looking for a code that lets you apply logical unitaries transversally. But we just found that for finite codes, there don't exist such maps. So not possible, and we reproduced the Easton-Knill theorem like this. But we also found in the infinite dimensional setting that we can use, say, continuous variables to get around this. So now there's a way to get around the Easton-Knill theorem using continuous variables. Okay, so this.
These groups you're using, though, they have to be like either amenable or compact or something to do this average over them, right? Like you can't do, you know, you need this averaging.
I guess it has to be compact, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, a lot of these are, I guess, ones of interest are probably satisfied properties.
Yeah, I mean, this might be a related issue, but notice this state here, so, you know, the state that you get by applying this to some input is non-normalizable. You end up with a sum over, yeah, so it's non-normalizable. That's an issue in this. Already here you see problems like this, so probably you need some compactness to make it.
So what actually goes wrong with the proof before?
For infinite dimensional things?
Yeah.
Yeah, good, okay. I wasn't gonna say it, I was waiting, so good. I didn't quite, yeah, I really didn't emphasize this. What you need is, sorry, I'll go back a bit. Here, this trace is not really well defined. And so breaks down. Good question. Okay, are there other questions? If not, to wake you up, I always like to put in a terrible joke, but I don't know any, so I was gonna just borrow from John Preskill's after dinner thing, so we'll just sing this together. Okay, ready? Need tenure or something. So now, okay, so everything we did so far was exact quantum error correction. Now we want to do the proximate case. In this case, we want to say, okay, right, so in the proof sketch that I showed you, we said, well, the environment shouldn't learn anything about the logical charge or the input. But what if it can learn a tiny bit? Then that proof is out the window. Or what if we only require that the encoding approximately be covariant? And can we use this somehow to strengthen, sadly, the Easton-Knill theorem. And before we do this, let's sort of get some consistency on our measures of how we quantify approximate. So there's this notion of state fidelity. Sometimes with a square, we use this one. And this kind of induces a fidelity on channels. Between two channels, you can just apply the channel to sort of half of this bipartite state and the other channel to half of the bipartite state. And compare the fidelity of those output states. But this is clearly a state-dependent definition, and so you could either do it for the one that gives you the entanglement fidelity, where you use the actual EPR pair, or you could do a worst-case one where you find the state that gives you the worst fidelity between the two. And now I've written these with just a single channel here, because what that means is really you're going to compare it to the identity. And the reason we do that is because we want to talk about a quality of a code, where you want to encode, noise, decode, and compare this to the identity. You should be able to get back to the input state, so you want this as a channel to be close to the identity, where you found the best possible recovery channel. Okay. This gives us something that we kind of call the error of a code or something. It's just this is how we define it. And if you take one thing away from this slide. It's that this quantity is the error of a code. It tells you how bad a code is. And so if it's close to zero, it means it's a great code. If this quantity is close to one, it's a good code. This is the quality is there, so close to zero, good. What we'll see is that actually we can show bounds that this is, that for in general, this is actually away from zero. So that there's a minimum badness of codes that are covariant. Okay, so we're making things approximate. Let's do an example. Let's come back to this one, this approximate code. So this was non-normalizable. Also, it uses infinite dimensions. Suppose we wanted to say, okay, we only care about a finite dimensional code. Can we make it approximately error correcting, but still covariant? One way to do that is to just truncate the size of the Hilbert space. So just truncate this sum so that it, you know, it has some finite range. And you can do the same on the input space. This is still a U1 covariant code, but it's finite dimensional. So we know by the theorem that this can't be a perfect code. And we'll see that in a sec. Also, this was non-normalizable. So you can try to make it normalizable just by putting in these Gaussian weights. And it turns out, actually, this one is also not a perfect code. Even though they both remain U1 covariant, there's a minimum error for both codes defined by this, you know, these cutoffs. And in this truncated one, you see, OK, in the physical systems have a finite range. The bound has to do with this range. M is in the denominator. So as you make that go to infinity, the code can become perfect. For a cutoff, it's bad, it's minimally bad. OK? So here's a theorem.
So it looks like the bounds and the second, the Gaussian envelope, are the tighter, basically.
Right.
Because it's both H over W on both sides. So it's...
But it's still sort of like using infinite. It's just that the...
Yeah. I'm just trying to compare which is a better way to do it.
Oh, yeah, this one. But still, like, because, yeah. Because you're not putting in a hard cutoff, you're sort of smoothly saying, yeah. It's just that now when you sort of try to decode, you're off by a slight amount, but it's, you know, it's the overlap of two Gaussians. So, okay. So the theorem, here's the picture. This one is for an isometric encoding, with V being the encoding isometry. You map the logical space with logical generator TL to the physical space with logical generators T1 to TN, such that the, you know, they're all local and the full thing is the sum. And you're correcting against the noise channel N. The minimum error is bounded like this, where now, so N here was the number of physical systems. So as you have more physical systems at your disposal, it's like saying the total output space is infinite dimensional or, you know, growing. There's some more intuition I can give there if you want. This delta T is the range of eigenvalues that you have for a generator, the largest eigenvalue minus the smallest eigenvalue. And this is kind of playing the role of the, say, the local Hilbert space dimension. You're saying that each charge value that you have is kind of like a degree of freedom in the physical systems. So if you let that charge range go to infinity, then you can have more ways of encoding the information such that the environment gets less and less by measuring each charge.
So this is also just approximately covariant, even if there's no error.
Shoot, now I can't remember. I will show one that has approximate covariance. I think this might be exactly covariant and just approximately error correcting. I could be wrong on this. It's failing memory.
I'm not very confused.
Sure.
Can you do some examples?
So in this example, the charge range, this example, the charge range here is 2m plus 1. So this would be 2m plus 1. So yeah, right. So delta T is, yeah, it look at the like a spectral decomposition of each generator. Take the biggest eigenvalue and the smallest eigenvalue, it's that range. And that sort of tells you how many possible values you have in that range. The more you have, the better you can correct, because you can kind of hide information in each logical system from the environment.
I mean, the first code is just finite dimensional, right? So
Yeah, this one. Yes.
So how can I mean, I guess.
Because it's finite dimensional, it'll have a minimum bound, right?
Yeah, so, no. Yeah. I know. But I'm
yeah.
sorry. I'm still asking my question, not Benny's question.
Oh, okay.
Which is, can I mean, it's a continuous group.
Yes.
And I guess in principle, it could still be, because there's superpositions, still be exactly covariant, but that doesn't seem likely.
It is exactly, this is exactly covariant.
Continuous group.
Under U1. It's exactly covariant. I mean, so you can, that little, you know, this post-it note that I had here, just do the same thing here. X, you'll still cancel everything out. The reason it's only approximately error correcting is because you might say, when you decode and you add this to this and this to this, that kind of thing, you might exceed the range of allowed values and cycle back, and so now it's off. But the covariance is exact.
No, but can't you also go outside the range of allowed values that way?
I don't think so.
I mean, you're summing over x in that range.
Sure, yeah. But it just because it's an isometry. So think of this as being applied to some state to get a state and then do the covariance on that state, if you want. Still skeptical?
Yeah, I'm skeptical.
Maybe you are right to be. I'm
we'll work out later.
Okay. It's entirely possible that I'm conflating many of the different things that we have in the paper, but this one I thought was, so we can do it later. All right, so then there's another bound if you used a different measure of the entanglement one, but we don't have to worry about it. The way that you prove these sorts of things is very similar to what we did in the first case. It has to do with looking what the environment gets. So we look at the complementary channel, which, to remind some of you, or for those of you who are not in this field as much, if you have a quantum channel from A to B, you can write that as a trace over C of some, acting on a bigger Hilbert space, the Steinspring dilation. The complementary channel of F is where you, instead of tracing over the environment, you trace over the one you cared about and look at the quantum channel from the input to the environment. That's what the complementary channel was. And in quantum error correction, you wanted the environment to get nothing. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to look at how close that complementary channel is to the constant channel. And so these are some results by Benny and Oreshkov, where they tell you that the fidelity or the error, the quality of the code has to do with how close your complementary channel is to the constant channel, the one that just gives you some state that doesn't depend on the input. Okay. So then you can do some math that I am not showing you at all, but by looking at sort of the largest and smallest charge eigenvalues, you can arrive at our bound. That's roughly what you have to do. You have to compute these things for the complementary channel. Okay. There's a more general version of the proof, and I won't spend too much time on this, but this allows the code itself to be only approximately covariant, that the input generator and the output generator are allowed to differ by some amount. This condition, don't worry about so much. It just says that you're only using a certain range, that you don't lose too much by truncating the range of charge values in your code. And so you see it's still kind of the same thing. Here, this is related to Will's question, where you're allowed to erase some subset of the output modes with a probability. That's what the alpha represents. Delta T is actually, here delta T is really just this range that I had, but it's the same sort of thing. It's like the maximum and minimal eigenvalues that you really care about. So again, same thing. So even if the code is only approximately covariant, and you only care about approximate error correction, there's still this bound. Okay. Are there questions? So this was the bulk of what I wanted to talk about, and I'll say something about ADS CFT in a sec.
So what happens if I have something with support over like a huge range of like the charge?
You mean where the code actually uses a huge range of charges?
Yeah.
Then it becomes a good code because this number grows.
Yeah. Is there intuition for
it? Kind of. So if the range of allowed charges is very large, when the environment measures the charge, some charge eigenvalue, it's only going to get some small amount of information because there's so many possible choices. Okay. Yeah.
So here you have a lower bound, right? So can that be also a upper bound?
So this was for any code, any encoding. So you could use one that just throws information away. It's sort of bad. It'll have a very bad covariance. Well, no, it won't actually. It'll have a good covariance, but it'll be just terrible error corrected code. So.
The lower bound can also be zero in some case.
Yeah. So, but in limits, right? Only in limits. Good.
Was anything we talked about specific to finite dimensional symmetries? So you have continuous symmetries, but if the actual group is infinite dimensional, does that dimension blowing up break anything?
So
you talked about continuous symmetries versus discrete symmetries.
Yes.
But if the dimension of the continuous
group is
infinite?
Yeah, I think you run into these sort of issues that we had earlier. I don't know how to think about those things. And I guess, Daniel, I'm just noticing now as well, if the logical space transforms trivially, then you can have a perfect code, right? So this is why, yeah. Okay, so different stuff, however related. So how many of you know ADS-CFT? Know what it is? Okay, so I won't spend... Well, that's good, because I don't have any slides to show you what it is. there's some standard lore that's been around for a long time that says that in this picture, there's no allowed global bulk symmetries. And the old argument was that you could make a black hole that had a lot of that charge, and as it evaporates without leaking information about the charge, it's not conserving charge. And so that wouldn't be allowed. You'd need it to be sort of gauged to work.
I guess this is also kind of like a... Maybe the holographic version of Daniel's question is we want to consider global symmetries which act non-trivially on our system?
Yes. That will be an assumption. Exactly. So we know that ADS-CFT, recently we know that it's an error correcting code, so can we use this stuff to understand what's going on here? So I guess I have this. That's right. So it's one slide. I'm not going to do it any justice. There's multiple years, but for the few of you that hadn't seen this before, ADS-CFT is this duality between gravity in some number of dimensions and a conformal field theory in fewer dimensions where the gravity, the space-time, you can represent it as a cylinder with time running upwards, and a spatial slice is the hyperbolic disk. Great. So what is true is that the full bulk theory is dual to the full boundary theory, but what's also true is this thing called subregion duality, where if you have a subregion of the boundary, then some appropriately defined corresponding subregion of the bulk, the entanglement wedge, is also dual to that. So there's a duality between this greenish bulk region and that boundary region A. That means we can map operators from one side to the other, and it was recently found that this procedure for doing this mapping is a quantum error correcting code. And hopefully that's familiar to many of you. So because it's quantum error correction, we can use this, and because there's this duality between subregion of the bulk, subregion of the boundary, we can maybe say something useful. Like this, there are no global symmetries. So this argument was made, was kind of proven by Dan Harlow and Hiroshi Oguri, referenced on the next slide, in two papers recently. And it goes something like this. So here's a time slice. Break the boundary into n, capital N pieces, called A1 to AN. Each of those pieces has its dual subregion, the entanglement wedge called A1, little a1 to little an. And then there's the remainder in the middle, A0. So suppose there was a global bulk symmetry, which transforms non-trivially in the bulk. Assume it's non-trivial. The action can be expressed as a tensor product over all the different sites. Just think of it like a lattice, for example. It's a tensor on each little site. So there's some tensor in this, there's some unitary in this region and one for each of the little regions. And we know that the bulk is dual to the boundary and that it's a code, so you can map these operators to the boundary. And you can write this as a tensor product on each of the regions of some other operator W. The fact that it's a tensor product is because the CFT is splittable. And so for the experts, that's this fact. And if you wanted, these are the two references. One of them is very long. Maybe go for the other one to start. Right, so you have a splittable theory. So you can write the action on the boundary. Just all that means is that you can write it as this tensor product. Now, we know that it's a code. And that means that you can erase any one of these subregions. And that's a correctable error from the perspective of this central region. Okay. Because you can correct for erasure of any one of them, it means you can apply any operator to any subregion AI, and that'll be a correctable error. So that means if you apply any one of, let's say, if W2 here is a correctable error if you only apply W2 from the perspective of A0. Now, in ADS CFT, the code space that people tend to talk about is it's often or usually low energy excitations above the vacuum. Something that looks like this. You take the vacuum, you add a few particles or something, you don't increase the energy too much. So that means the code space on the boundary corresponds to the low energy things. So if you can argue that any one of these W's doesn't increase the energy of the CFT too much, then you've shown that it is it preserves the code space. It maps low energy states to low energy states, so the code space is preserved. An operator that maps code space to code space is a logical operator. And what Harlow and Oguri did is they showed this. They showed that these are, in fact, they do preserve the low energy subspace, and so that these are logical operators. But now this argument says they're logical operators that are also correctable errors. So they both map you out of the code space and preserve the code space, so they have to be trivial. And that was their argument, translated into this kind of language a little bit more. Okay, so this is how you say, if you had a non-trivial global symmetry here, then you end up with a contradiction. The only way out was for this to actually be trivial.
Sorry, what was the argument that it maps you out of the code space again?
These are, each A, capital AI, is a correctable error. You can erase that region. And erasure of that region is a correctable error. Let's just say in terms of qubits, if you have a bunch of qubits, if you can throw this one away and still decode, you could also throw it away and just apply an arbitrary operator to it and still decode. So here, any operator I apply on some subregion will not change anything. So you can apply this and it'll be a correctable error. A correctable error is one that screws up the code space, so you can detect it and reverse it.
The argument is that each WI separately is low energy.
Separately, yes. Good. So let me tell you the following thing, that you can build codes that in the quantum info community would call a holographic code, something like the happy code, where each constituent tensor is, in fact, a covariant code. So you can build a sort of like holographic, kind of hyperbolic-looking tensor network where each tensor is a quantum error-correcting code that's covariant. So you can build something that looks like a covariant holographic code.
Is it a finite?
Yes. Or you could do a finite-dimensional thing where the symmetry group is only finite-dimensional. I should say here, in here, their argument, this argument we went through is true for both continuous and finite groups. So, but clearly, because I just told you that you can build such things, and I haven't shown you there's examples in the paper, you needed an extra ingredient from full-blown ADS CFT, and what it was is this fact, that the code space is low-energy things. So this was the important input, and if there are experts who are worried about this, that you know that if you have some logical operator in the bulk, there has to be a gravitational dressing to make it local. So does this dressing screw up the argument somehow? The answer is no, because it's just gravitational. It doesn't care about the charge. It doesn't transform under the group. So it transforms trivially. And so you can sweep it under the rug, and it doesn't screw anything up.
So this A0 is a comparator which are the charge there, the center?
This? This?
A0
is just labeling the entanglement wedge of this. It's labeling this region. The symmetry is the full global bulk symmetry is a tensor product over all the logical legs.
So logical information we are thinking about is leaving out the center.
Also in these, but we're focusing on this one. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. All right. Good. So. Right. So the last thing that maybe I'll say is the following, that another thing that is true in ADS-CFT is that time evolution of the bulk is supposed to be the same as time evolution of the boundary. It's a duality between the two theories, and that you know both sides are time translation invariant, at least you know if you fix a time slice for the bulk. So somehow this bulk to boundary mapping should be covariant with respect to that symmetry. So why does this argument on the last slide not apply to time evolution? What's different? And it's precisely this dressing, which seemed like a point that we didn't have to care about, where in what we just said is that, okay, well, the gravitational dressing transforms trivially under the group, but here, it doesn't. The time evolution cares about the stress energy tensor or something. So it does not transform non-trivially. And in fact, the way it transforms is what gives you time evolution in the bulk. So that dressing that we could ignore before is exactly what makes this possible for time evolution. And two other points are just that formally these things should be infinite dimensional, and also we know that it should be actually technically an approximate error correcting code, and so this exact argument that we just said is not quite correct. So I guess I'm now at 57 minutes, I'll stop here. Thanks. Yeah, please.
I mean, the gravitational dressing, I agree, is an issue, but maybe there's something even a little bit simpler, which is just that under time translation, this decomposition of the subsystems A1 through AN is not going to be preserved as well.
That's maybe also true, yes.
So
that's a good point.
I'm not sure if you can even...
But if
I don't know. You have to somehow make the boundary, you know, make them overlapping a little bit, or what you...
Well,
I don't know what you have.
I mean, formally this is probably true, but you just sort of end up with a big entangled state, but you could still consider the same sort of decomposition at each time step, could you not?
But the time evolution operator on the whole thing can't be written as a product.
Yeah, fair, yes. There are lots of subtleties. As there's also the fact that they're gauge theories and things like that. It gets, there are a lot of more complicated things, no?
You mean that the boundary might be a gauge theory?
Yeah.
Yeah, but
so ignoring this as well. Okay, fair.
Or something.
Yeah.
Even there, you'll have some hopping between the.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So I guess relatedly, if I think about logical operators sitting at the center of the bulk, then that one should carry high complexity.
Okay. Yeah.
I cannot send a signal from boundary to center at the infinite speed.
Yep.
So that one should carry lots of. Circuit complexity, so I shouldn't be able to break it down to
On the boundary? But the theory is splittable,
okay,
so any operator can.
Well, if it's transversal, like tensor product, then I can implement it like instantaneously.
Well, each thing will be also very high complexity necessarily.
Well,
and there's also the fact that, I mean, technically, there's this tiny little overlap region here, so you might have to worry about it, but it's not crucial.
Yeah, so maybe this W1, W2.
Those may be high complexity. Yes, I would say so.
But
you could make them those regions arbitrarily small.
Also true. But then this region gets larger. I guess it doesn't really matter. Yeah.
Yeah.
For the Eastinale theorem, kind of you mentioned the trees cannot be well defined. Can you explain more?
In the proof sketch that I showed?
Yeah.
I mean, it was just that you're taking a trace in an infinite dimensional thing. And so, right? Yeah, I mean.
But that, I mean, that's common, like in, say, optics or quantum field theory.
Yeah, but you have to be careful about these things. And
define
trace. Trace class operators for infinite dimensional.
Sure.
It's messy.
It's messy. And I showed you on the next slide that you can do things that are infinite dimensional, which would otherwise violate a theorem that would apply. So something has to break, and I don't think there's anywhere else. I think it was just this trace.
Yeah, but I mean, like optics and quantum field theory.
Sure.
It works pretty well.
Yes. I think what I would say to this is it's a formal, like you can do these things, sure, but this was a formal proof, and in this formal proof there was a step that was not valid in the infinite dimensional setting, and you would have to treat more carefully, and you'd find that it does not carry over.
So I mean, it seems probably related to having these non-normalizable states as covariance, right? The trace and the norm is kind of
exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, but is it like a very naive idea is you can use like coherent state, define some code like using coherent state.
But this is an infinite dimensional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think probably in optical systems, the real answer is that all of this stuff is approximate. There's, I mean, if you want to do it, frequently you do it by normalization, but it's also accurate to say you don't have an exact coherent state, you just have something that's very close to
right. Exactly. But then this bound will apply. Yeah.
High numbers that
yeah.
It tells off.
Exactly. And I didn't say this, but only because you said the words Easton-Camille, you can actually apply the bound that we had in the approximate case. You could just apply this to the particular group of UD or SUD, in fact, and you can see that you can derive bounds on the covariance with respect to that group, which tells you that the Easton-Camille can be made sort of rigid, approximate. And so that didn't state, but snuck in because you said the words, so I cheated. Yeah.
Any last questions for our speaker? Let's thank Grant again.
Thank you.